Well, our next guest with our JFK assassination special is Dr. Walt Brown. Dr. Brown was with me 6 years ago as we talked about the Kennedy assassination. Noted author and researcher, some of his works, Treachery in Dallas, People versus Lee Harvey Oswald, The Warren Omission, JFK Master Chronology. We will be back with Dr. Brown in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Walt Brown, PhD, former FBI agent, spent years indexing, cataloging, researching all the known evidence out there in the assassination of President Kennedy. His global index to the assassination of JFK is considered the definitive researcher's tool. Editor of the Deep Politics Quarterly, his knowledge of the JFK assassination is unsurpassed. And I welcome him back on Coast to Coast. Walt, how are you?
Oh, George, it's good to be back with you, and I want to thank you for extending November 22nd, because where I am, it's Saturday, but you're still right. November 22nd, so that's a good thing.
We're still doing this, Walt. And, it's something I just can't give up. You know, I was 13 years old when this happened, and we still don't 16. Have the answers. Jeez.
Well, but we got a lot of good questions in the Master Chronology.
Yeah, let's go through some of the work. And also, Walt, you know, former FBI agent, what happened? What was the turning point for you when you decided there's something wrong here?
Yeah, part of it, when I worked for the Department of Justice, and that was 1969, the one thing you could not talk about was Dallas.
Interesting.
And I had already read Mark Lane, Harold Weisberg, Richard Popkin, Josiah Thompson, and I knew something was very wrong. And when I went to work in the Justice Department, I said, "Hey, what's the deal with Dallas?" Silence. The curtain came down, and that was lighting the match, so to speak.
Yeah. It was frightening to know.
And at the same time. And I'm sure your audience would appreciate this more than some of the radio audiences that I speak to. But when I worked with the Department of Justice, Nixon was president, and it was as corrupt as you could imagine.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And you said, wait a minute, I signed on for, you know, truth, justice, and the American way like Superman, and this is political chicanery at its worst. So it was a two-edged sword, but both edges were ugly.
I always thought, Walt, that Nixon knew what happened to Kennedy. He knew it all.
I have no hesitation that he did. He certainly had knowledge that the Warren Commission was a house of cards, and he said that on a number of occasions.
Some of the players involved in Watergate, were they involved in the JFK assassination? Hunt.
I can only definitively answer you to the extent that I can say their names that have been included in the stew.
Yeah.
I can't prove that E. Howard Hunt was or wasn't. The Watergate burglars as a group, almost to a man, show up somewhere along the line. But again, what's lacking is the proof. And when E. Howard Hunt is on his deathbed and confesses to his son so the son can make some money, you have to wonder about the credibility about that. Just as you have to question the credibility of the two dozen new stories that have come out in the last 4 days.
Yeah, all kinds of things.
You know, I was JFK's mistress, said great-grandma so-and-so.
Yeah.
You know, that's something you say within 5 years of the event, or you keep silent.
That's right. When most of the players are dead, you don't pop up and say it.
No, because there's nobody there to say, well, gee, no, you're lying. We were all there and you weren't.
Yeah, that's
right. You're telling a story that can't be debunked, except in the sense that it's self-debunking.
Well, what did you see, Walt, that for you was that turning point? You know, when you were investigating now, not when you were the 16-year-old kid. But what did you see, and it stood out, and you said there's something wrong here?
Well, two things. One, is that so much evidentiary material was locked away, and I'm going to use quotation marks, forever. And the obvious implication is that if Lee Oswald did this whole thing by himself, there shouldn't be one piece of paper locked away.
That's right.
It should all be out there.
That's right.
He did it by himself. Here's all the papers. But when they lock stuff away, then you worry. And the review board, which you're familiar with, declassified a lot of materials. And then in 2006, the Bush administration reclassified 55,000 JFK documents. Possession of them became a felony under the Official Secrets Act. And I wrote a letter to the archives to say, what do I have to give back or what do I have to destroy to be in compliance?
Yeah.
The archives wrote me a letter and said, we can't tell you because it's classified.
Why did they do that?
Because it's classified. It's beyond your imagination and mine to figure out why they did it. The second thing that really lit the fire, so to speak, was when I was in the DOJ, we had weapons training. And when we were done with the weapons training, I came out the best shot in the class. And I wound up with a master expert rating.
That's good.
My weapons officer was stationed at Fort Belvoir. He was Spec 6, and his name was Bancroft C. Miller. If you search through the Warren volumes, you're going to find out that one of the three people that the FBI used in that bogus reconstruction from a two-story tower with stationary targets
right. And
practice, one of those three people was Bancroft's Specialist Miller. And I talked to him about it, and he said, hell, I couldn't do it. And if this guy couldn't do it, you got a problem. Because this guy could draw two six-guns, shoot the ears off a flea, and not otherwise hurt the flea.
Yeah.
And I've heard stories the shot can be made. And I'll say this. Yes, it could. A master expert with a supremely good sniper weapon and simulated practice from a elevated perch on a moving target, yeah, it's doable. But let's look at Oswald. The Marine Corps colonel that testified about Oswald's shooting ability characterized him as a rather poor shot. That's critical.
Yeah.
And that's strike one. The FBI laboratory expert, Sebastian Latona, that testified about examining the Mannlicher and not finding fingerprints, was, why didn't you find any? And he said, it's a cheap old gun. Strike two. Then you have Oswald's last known rifle experience, May 6th, 1959, in the Marine Corps. Then he musters out of the Marine Corps, goes to Russia, where you cannot own a rifle. There is not a sentence of proof that Oswald fired a rifle from May 6th of 1959, literally until the day he died. No proof. That's 1,651 days. And I know from my own experience, to keep your edge at target shooting, it's constant.
To keep your edge with anything, Walt, you got to keep it.
Well, but I can put a softball bat down in September and pick it up again in April and start hitting grounders or take batting practice. But that doesn't mean I'm going to hit the first pitch over center field fence.
That's right.
And then the fourth thing as far as Oswald goes, and any hunter will back this up. When you get your weapon ready to go hunting, whether it's for big game or politicians, it's got to be sighted in. Now, officially, Oswald took the gun into the book depository in a paper bag and assembled it inside the book depository. So that gun was never sighted in. And it usually takes between 10 and 12 shots to get the telescopic sight right where you want it. And of course, when the FBI got their hands on it, they bench-viced it, they fired it, and it was constantly firing high and to the right. Warren Commission conclusion. Yes, the gun fired high and to the right, but that was an advantage to the sniper Oswald because the car was going down to the left. So you've got a rather poor shot with a cheap old weapon, 1,651 days without his edge, and a gun that's not sighted in.
And that is verbiage. I'm a patsy.
Yeah, well, that too. And if we have time, that's his second patsy experience. But if you took somebody in Major League Baseball, and the guy had an average of 191, and he was cut from the team in 2008, didn't swing a bat until today. You give him a lousy bat, say, stand in the batter's box, you can loosen up a little bit, but the first two swings you take, the ball has to go over the center field fence. It's not going to happen.
Not going to happen at all.
Not in 1,000 years.
Nope.
And that's easier than two shots in the small target that the sniper would have had to have been firing at the motorcade.
And let me ask you this, Walt, because as a former Justice Department official, FBI agent, the Secret Service seemed to be, because I've looked at this video over and over again, they're jogging alongside the presidential limousine. And then all of a sudden, they're called off. The one Secret Service agent throws his hands up in the air, and it's a gesture of what the heck are you people doing to me?
Yeah.
What was that about?
The closest I can get to it, and it deals essentially with in a larger way, the Secret Service failure. And given a minute, I can walk through it.
Yeah.
The agent in question was Donald Lawton. And every place, every city that Kennedy went to, and he was in Florida till Monday of the last week, and then he was in Dallas in five places. There were five advance agents sent to those cities. Now, the one we know best, of course, is Winston Lawson in Dallas. Every site that Kennedy visited, there was an advance agent. So there was an advance agent at the Hotel Texas that morning. There was an advance agent at Love Field to do double duty as the Air Force One arrived and as it departed. There's an advance agent at the trademark, David Grant. He's still alive. And the fellow that gets waved off was the advance agent at the airport. That was his job. Now, what he ran out, why he went jogging out there and asked Emory Roberts something, I don't know, because he didn't leave any memoirs.
But it's
a gesture of futility.
Exactly. And when you throw your hands up in the air, you're frustrated.
Yeah. And one of the things is that the story about Kennedy ordering the guys off the back of the car in Tampa, he was one of the two guys ordered off the back. Donald Lawton and Chuck Zborl. They were the two guys tossed. And he may have been, you know, trying to make a point. Who knows? But his job was technically to stay at Love Field.
Now, let me ask you.
The person that reacted, and you can see this in the video, the second Secret Service agent on the running board sees him coming along, and he jumps into the car. And people have taken that as proof as well. This guy should have been going along. The guy that jumped in the car was Paul Landis. He was Mrs. Kennedy's agent, and that was his first presidential motorcade. So he could have made a mistake. That agent has been misidentified a few times, and there's wiggle room there. But at the end of the day, the problem is the Secret Service was overwhelmed. The White House detail is 40 guys.
Yet they're called off at the point that the shooting is going to occur. What are the odds of that happening?
Thin and none.
Exactly.
Thin and none. but they were stretched so thin. If you look at the pedigree of the agents in the follow-up car, you come up a buck short. Two of them are Mrs. Kennedy's agents, Clint Hill and Paul Landis.
I think one of the shooters.
Two of them are driver agents.
Okay, but listen, I think one of the shooters from someplace probably radioed back to somebody and said, I can't get a clear shot. Get these agents out of the way. And they called them off.
Well, I don't see any movement on Elm Street that was a threat. And the stories about shots from the second floor to Dow Tech's building, those shots would not have cleared the Secret Service agents who were sitting up on the back of the follow-up car. Because, again, as you're aware and the people listening are aware, Elm Street goes downhill, and the president's car is 10 inches lower than the follow-up, so they would have had no sight picture, no. Unless they're up on the fifth floor or the roof. Then they got a shot, and there's nobody in the way. But, again, it was a makeshift lineup.
Since you began investigating this case,
yeah,
have you changed your mind on anything, or has anything new popped up that you might want to share with us?
Well, the one thing that really struck me as I lined up the ducks in the chronology is the overwhelming non-coincidental presence of U.S. Army intelligence. And that when I connected those dots, I said, "Whoa, that's Marina Oswald was Ruth." Well, Ruth Payne was contacted by somebody named J.D. Wilmoth, who wanted to hear what a woman from Archangel, Marina, sounded like when she spoke Russian. So he set up an appointment for Tuesday, the 19th of November. And he visited Ruth Payne and Marina Oswald. Turns out he was a colonel in U.S. Army intelligence. He had served in the Moscow legation in World War II. Obviously. He had a Ph.D. in Russian, and he no more needed to hear what Marina Oswald sounded like than you and I needed lessons in English grammar.
What do you think his purpose of trying to visit?
He was on a mission. He was there to say to Marina, and wink at Ruth Payne, who probably already knew the story, "Listen, the world's going to fall on Lee Oswald real soon. You can either help us have the world fall on Lee Oswald, or the world's going to fall on you too, Marina." And she sold Lee Oswald out in a heartbeat.
Yeah, sold him out.
Now, fast forward to Friday. The car that's in front of Jesse Curry, Kennedy's car was fourth in the overall parade.
Okay.
It's one car a mile ahead. There's a car 250 yards ahead, then Curry, then Kennedy. The car ahead of Curry was driven by Deputy Chief Lumpkin of the Dallas Police. Also in the car was a Colonel Albert Whitmire.
And why are they in the parade? They're just there for security?
Well, they're so to speak, the last resort. The first car makes sure that the traffic officers, and the only security for Kennedy was traffic officers. These guys were stopping traffic. There were no detectives out there on the street.
Makes no sense.
It was just,
yeah.
It's just traffic officers.
How naive.
The first car was driven by Purdue Lawrence, who was a traffic captain. He's making sure that the guys are at their assigned places. The second car is the court of last resort. But they stopped where the epileptic had the fit. And that's an oddity. But they weren't stopping about the epileptic. There was a man named James Powell standing on that corner. He was an agent of U.S. Army intelligence.
What the heck was he doing? Hold on, Walt. We're going to hit the break. We'll get you to answer that when we come back. And we're going to continue. Walter Brown with us, Dr. Walt Brown. We'll talk about his research. And we'll take some of your calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our JFK special on Coast to Coast AM. Walter Brown with us here. Walt, so a couple of the cars in front of Kennedy's car seem to be stopping for this individual. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me just shortstop that for one thought. I heard during your commercial you say you have to look at all the conspiracies to see if there's a conspiracy. And that was one of the raison d'etre of the chronology before it became 32,000 pages. Let's examine all of them.
Yep.
See what works, see what doesn't. Okay, two cars in front of Kennedy stops on this corner to talk to James Powell. He's U.S. Army intelligence. His job was to make sure the patsy was in the building. Because Oswald went home, well, he went to Ruth Payne's house on Thursday. If Wesley Frazier had awakened with the 24-hour flu, what's Oswald going to do? He can't go back to Ruth Payne's house, supposedly with a rifle, and say, listen, Ruth, can you get me and the gun to the building today? They had to make sure the patsy was in place. And Powell took a photograph of the empty window. He had his camera with him. He was all set to go. But by taking a picture of the empty window, you can say, well, that's where Oswald was. Mm-hmm. If he wanted to, he could have taken a picture of the real shooter if there was one in that window. The two guys that are in the front seat of that car that stopped for him are the co-commanders of the Dallas East Army Reserve. So when you hear stories about, well, the Army presence was ordered to stand down, the two guys in front of Curry's car are responsible for that. And that's too much of a coincidence.
The whole thing's bizarre.
Later that afternoon, a guy named Jack Crichton arranges for a translator for Marina Oswald. Jack Crichton had ties to U.S. Army intelligence and corporate Texas. He and George de Morenschild, and this is a familiar name, in the 1950s had attempted to buy oil leases in Cuba that would have covered half of the island of Cuba. After the assassination, after he gets a translator that hangs Marina out to dry, he becomes a muckety-muck in NAFCO Oil and Gas, making him partners with a man named D. Harold Byrd, who owned the building that was leased to the Book Depository Company. And he ran for governor on a ticket that included George H.W. Bush running for either the House or the Senate. And they're already strange bedfellows in 1964. Neither of them won. But it calls into question who he's associating with. And the final link is that the last phone call Oswald tried to make, and it's always been kind of a mystery. You know, he called somebody in North Carolina. And people think, oh, it's that dentist he met in Russia, Alexis Davidson. No, he was calling a guy named John Hurt, who was a serious, high-up muckety-muck in U.S. Army intelligence. And when he gave the number to the Dallas police operator, there were guys there, and I'm quoting, in suits, that said, find out who that number tracks to. And when they found out who the number tracks to, they didn't put the call through. So they're telling Oswald, it's ringing, Mr. Oswald, it's ringing, it's still ringing, nobody's home. And that was Oswald's last attempt to make the phone call. Now, something that I presented that out at the WEX Symposium in Pittsburgh, and someone that was sitting in the audience, because the brochure from the WEX Symposium, which is always professionally done, it had a copy of that famous letter that I know you're familiar with,
that's the pathology.
Your listeners, Dear Mr. Hunt. You know, the letter that Lee Oswald wrote, Dear Mr. Hunt, blah, blah, yeah. Blah, what do I do? He came up to me and he said, could this be a letter to Dear Mr. Hurt? And I said, yeah, it could. Let's look at the letters, the way they're formed in that note. And it's possible. It's possible that note was not written to anybody named Hunt, but rather to a higher up in Army Intel named Hurt.
Well, do you think Oswald was in on what was going on? He calls himself the patsy, or do you think he didn't even know what was happening?
I think he was led to believe that something else was happening, and the something else was along the lines of, listen, Lee, what we need you to do is create a legend for, let's call him Alec Heidel. Have Heidel buy a weapon. Have Heidel get arrested handing out Castro leaflets. Then we're going to have a shot fired out into the lawn in Dealey Plaza, not hurting anybody, because the lawn was technically off limits that day, little known fact. Nobody was supposed to be there. We're going to fire a shot out into the lawn. Kennedy's going to be protected. They'll rush him to the Johnson Ranch. He'll be surrounded by right-wing Texas conservatives. The evidence is immediately, going to track to this Cuban fanatic named Heidel, and they're going to say to Kennedy, hey, You're John Kennedy. You don't get mad. You get even. Let's go get Cuba.
Let's go get him.
And the cabinet is in Tokyo. Bobby's back in Washington. Kennedy is literally surrounded by people of different opinion than he was. But it could have been a very convenient. And you, Lee Oswald, at the end of the day, the United States is going to get Cuba back on our side of the fence. You're going to be the hero of this piece.
And so
when he heard the siren, and when Roy Truly stuck his nose in the second floor lunchroom and said the president's been shot, chances are Oswald soiled himself because he wasn't expecting that. What did he do? He went home to get the gun. But did he go right home and tell the cab, stay here? And no, he got out six blocks away. He knew there was a possible ambush. And then a police car shows up with two cops in it while he's inside 1026 North Beckley. It was all orchestrated.
And they had to get rid of Oswald because he knew too much.
Yeah, because his ace in the hole was, hey, I know what the real story is. And when he said, I'm just a patsy, he was telling the truth because he had had patsy experience once before with the U2.
I want to ask you about your index in a second. Let's take a few calls here for folks lining up with you. David in Chicago, welcome to the program. David, you're on with Dr. Walt Brown. Go ahead.
George, I knew we could count on you to do a fantastic job on this tonight.
These guests
are wonderful show. Mr. Brown, I have heard that the night of the incident, that the autopsy report was pushed into the fireplace by Lyndon B. Johnson. Just wanted to get your opinion on that. And have you ever heard of anything like connect?
No, I haven't. The story that I can relate to fireplace is that Commander Humes took notes home from the autopsy. And then between, I'm going to say at about the middle of the night, Sunday into early Sunday afternoon, he wrote the final autopsy report. And then he burned notes by his statement in the fireplace of his rec room. And the story was he burned stuff that had Kennedy's blood on it. And he didn't want it to wind up in a museum of some cheesy roadside stand on Route 66. But that story doesn't wash. The notes should have survived. Absolutely. In that case. And that's as close as we get. But as far as Johnson burning anything, I've never heard that.
Walt, let me ask you about the brain of the president. Yes. I've always heard it's gone. It's missing.
Yep.
Who took it?
There's two alleys you can follow. One story is that, in both cases, the brain was removed, and it was removed before Fink even got to the autopsy. He was late. They put it in a bucket of formalin solution to fix the brain, to harden it so that it's no longer fresh jello, but it's week old jello, and you can cut it into sections.
Okay.
They then, sometime approximately a week later, sectioned it, and the slides were eventually thrown out by the FBI because they were taking up too much room because they would have filled a Band-Aid can. The brain itself, in that scenario, was given over to the Kennedy, the Kennedy Trust temporarily, which was Burke Marshall and Angie Novello. It was listed on the National Archives inventory as a stainless steel container containing gross material. And they don't mean gross by disgusting. They just mean a massive material.
Massive excess.
That's one road that the story can go down. The other story is the Humes testified later on in his life, it may have even been to the review board in the 90s, that Admiral Berkeley was just busting his chops, like, we've got to bury the brain with the body. And Humes just had heard that so many times, he finally said, here, take it, and handed him the bucket with the brain in it, which would have been at the latest Saturday sometime, which meant that the autopsy, the sectioning, and the photographs of that survived are some other brain. And you could probably find some scenario in which case there was a brief window of time when only the Marine Guard or the military guard was guarding the coffin, perhaps after the people were locked out of the U.S. Capitol building, but before it was taken back to the White House. And in this scenario, the brain could have possibly gone into the coffin then. But they're two totally counterproductive scenarios.
You don't think the brain, though, disappeared because of the conspiracy of the grassy knoll in the angle and all that?
That, again, is a clear possibility. But the secondary possibility is that the Kennedy family, which was very, very overly protective of things, and you can say, well, they were overprotective. They didn't want conspiracy getting out, because if conspiracy gets out, Robert Kennedy's candidacy goes up the chimney, because the same conspirators will kill him that killed John.
That's right.
So they have to keep conspiracy low.
And they may have.
They went to a lot of trouble. The Kennedy family purchased the ambulance that drove the body from Andrews Air Force Base to Bethesda, and they had it crushed for landfill. That thing contains no evidence whatsoever. It's just something they didn't want on display. And then a year ago, that ambulance, which was crushed, was sold on eBay for $116,000. Somebody saw the numbers, got a similar ambulance, painted it up, and sold it.
And tricked somebody.
So there's always a couple of slants. And in the chronology that I just finished, I always put all of the slants in the analysis. All the possibilities. This could be this. It could be this. Pick your poison.
Let's go to Aaron and Prince Frederick, Maryland. Aaron, go ahead. You're on with us.
I was wondering if you could talk about the Zapruder film and whether or not it's ballistic evidence that Kennedy was shot by more than one shooter.
It's, first of all, let's leave the Zapruder film as the bait. You know, it's the real film. Because I can't prove that it was altered.
No.
I can't do that. There's people who say they can, and maybe they can. What it shows is strongly suggestive of a wound from the front. Strongly suggestive. However, is it possible that a shot in the head could have impacted from behind and shown what we saw in the Zapruder film? And yes, it is possible. But it's not possible that it could have been fired from Oswald. Because it would have been fired from a position well south of him, and it would have hit down onto the top of the head, which could easily have driven the head backwards. But again, without proper photographs, without proper X-rays, and certainly by silencing the Dallas doctors for a long time, we don't get the sense of what the president really looked like.
Walter, how long do you think the scheme was planned? A year ahead? 2 years ahead of the assassination?
I think the concept was born not long after the Bay of Pigs. And I think it just simply grew in intensity when Kennedy refused to go after Cuba at the time of the missile crisis, when Kennedy gave the American University speech, when the day after he gave a speech on racial integration that wasn't widely accepted. And I think one of the critical things that's often overlooked is the day, August 9th of 1963, when John Kennedy's baby died. And I think he was so devastated by that he had it in his mind he was not going to write more letters to parents of Vietnam
victims. Yeah, you're right.
And that was one of the critical points in his decision to say enough on Vietnam. And then he went went to the UN and said, hey, we've got a test ban treaty. And at the end of the day, the people have said John Kennedy was going to end the Cold War. And I expanded that in the chronology to say not only was he going to expand the Cold War, he was going to end the Cold War, rather, but he was going to expose the Cold War for the military-industrial fraud that it was. The only Cold War existed over the city of Berlin, where the Soviets had a lot of troops and we had a smaller number. As far as strategic weapons, the Soviets had nothing, and we had an arsenal.
How close?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
How close do you think Jim Garrison was to getting this thing?
I think he found a piece of something. I think he found a solid piece of something, because there's people with cross ties to the assassination week. There was one guy that they couldn't quite put a pedigree on from Chicago that visited Ruby's Club on Thursday night, and he was with a woman named Jean Aase, which is spelled A-A-S-E, and she was cited as a, quote, very accommodating broad. And the Warren Commission didn't take much notice of her, but the FBI did, because they could not get to the bottom of why she got so many phone calls after mid-September from David Ferry.
Because
Shaw is not going to pick up the phone. Somebody's going to do it for him.
That's right.
And he had plenty of intel help surrounding him. And just to get back to that guy that took the picture of the window, when you fast forward to Martin Luther King, you remember that the famous picture where all of the people are on a balcony pointing in one direction where the shot came from? That photo was taken by U.S. Army intelligence. They show up at cameras at the strangest places.
In the moment we have left with you, Walt, I want you, we only got about a minute, but tell me, in your best guess, based on the things you've looked at, who killed Kennedy? What kind of group?
Well, it was certainly nothing foreign. It was domestic. And I don't think it was Lyndon Johnson, because he was a gutless coward. I think it was people who, you know, government insiders, you know, call them rogues, if you will, but not necessarily rogue CIA, but, you know, people who wanted a war, military people who wanted to go from colonel to general and get the perks and not retire as colonels. People who wanted to clean out the rat's nest that they were seeing develop because of Cuba and Soviet Third World.
It was a coup, Walt. It was a coup, no doubt. Thank you for being with us this hour. Up next, Dr. Jerry Corsi was with his thoughts on Coast to Coast AM.